permission to practice conversation between teachers and teacher educators about research and practice. In episode 18, the panel discusses Langston Clark's 2020 paper, Toward a Critical Race Pedagogy of Physical Education, from the journal Physical Education and Sport Pedagogy. I begin with the rationale for my choice of this paper and the challenges I perceived and experienced in this space.
Okay, so thanks everyone. I've decided to kick this off myself to start with and try and give a background to why I chose this paper, why I wrote what I wrote at the beginning in terms of the reflection, and then kind of invite everybody else to contribute to this discussion. I was looking for a paper this week and I wasn't sure where to go, and I get physical education and sport pedagogy all the time. I get it every month through my door. I'm on the editorial, but I'm an associate editor, so I get it. And there'd been this big pile of journals in my pigeonhole at work, and we've obviously been teaching at home, and I went in and I thought, right, well, I'll open them all up and I'll start to look through them. And I came across Langston's paper, and I kind of went, oh, well, that looks really interesting. Well, that looks quite challenging. In terms of looking at it. And I did Omanar and I looked elsewhere, but I kept coming back to it thinking, no, part of this process is to challenge myself and to learn and to understand. So I read the paper and then I wrote, I think, which is my longest blog, because I was trying to explain terminology that was, and ideas that were not familiar to me. And having read through Brian's work previously and listening to him and his acknowledgements of race and his position and my positionality, I tried to do that as well. And I think I've probably done an adequate job, and I encourage everyone to read the paper and to consider it, because I think it's a very challenging piece in terms of looking at, whiteness, white privilege, the way white privilege influences and impacts upon so many aspects of what we do, and how we expect young people to have voices and to interact within the systems that are predominantly white, determined by white, governed by white, and what that means. So that's why I felt it was important to look at this paper. It took me an extra day to do. Pressing send, I wanted to make sure I'd done the best job that I could. And that's where we are, really. And I think that, you know, these are really important issues to consider. And I invite you to consider them now with me, I guess.
I'll go. I read the paper, and based not on what's in it, just as a paper, I found it, as you say, a challenge. I thought it was trying to follow what it was saying, I found really difficult. I think it might have been, I don't know, overcomplicated is probably the wrong word, but there was a lot of specific terminology that I didn't know. And yeah, as you say, it took a long time to get through it, to figure out what they were trying to say for me. But I think the issues that it touches on are very, very current. And yeah, I'll stop there.
Charlie, I think there is a big difference between, you know, reading for understanding and being impacted by something. And I think you've talked about both of those things. I did find it, theoretically dense paper. I did find it, a challenge to, it is a challenge to Pete. It's a challenge to physical education, teacher education. So there is an expectation of a certain level of learning to understand it. So, you know, as a teacher, it's not easy to access the language. And I guess what you've talked about there is not accessing the language, but accessing the ideas, which I think is a very important distinction to make.
If I can jump in, Ash, I can resonate with Charlie's perspective. I read this article several months ago, and then I'm glad you selected it for today's podcast and blog this week. And I get a chance to take a look at it again. Obviously, I applaud Dr. Clark's efforts, and I think that his approach to being critical is noteworthy. It's funny you mentioned Dr. Culp as well. when reading this article, I kept on thinking back to, you know, his literature, particularly the point that he makes about listening. And having read this article a few times, I really think there is an essence in the article about listening here that I think is important. You know, again, Dr. Clark talks about applauding the social justice efforts that have gone, that have taken place recently. And, he's unapologetic about that, but also at the same time is critical and says that we have to be deliberate. And I think that really segues nicely from last week, a completely different topic. But I think we mentioned the idea of being measured, being deliberate. And he challenges us to be deliberate when we think about race in physical education and PEAT programs. And again, I applaud him for that. I took part in a book club a few months ago with Dr. Martin, and we tackled a challenging book as well. And we talked about how we needed to be deliberate. And at times when reading that book, dealing with social justice issues and particularly race, as a parent, not only as a faculty member, but as a parent, I felt challenged and thought to myself, I could do better when it comes to teaching my children about race and the importance and the history of some of the fantastic heroines in not only Black history, but perhaps Black PEAT and Black physical education as well.
So, reading yours and then his paper and kind of like going through and trying to visualize what the paper means and the experiences that I've had. And I'll just say this is normal. I'm a cisgender white male working in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm a white male teacher in a classroom where 98% of students are Black and from a completely different community in which I grew up in. And over the years, I've had conversations with friends and whether I actually even belong in that classroom, whether I actually should be there. And I think there's a lot of validity in what he mentions in the white institutions or predominantly white institutions, in that so much that's structured within our schools and specifically Philadelphia kind of like follows that mindset. And even recently, as I found out, the other person that teaches in the department, she's moving to a different role and there's an opening. And there was a conversation with my AP. And I go straight back to Dr. Blackshear, Tara Blackshear's paper that talked about Shaped So White and like the ratings that go on with teachers. And the AP made a comment, well, all these other teachers had really low ratings. And then in my brain, it didn't pop in right away. But as I got home, I was wondering, are we just going to pick another white person because they hit certain marks on a score instead of actually trying to change the institution to represent the community? And do students have representation? So a lot of what I've seen, witnessed, and experienced in Philly, like there's not one mark that I can really disagree with in the paper and how, like, the interactions that we've intentionally created through systems in the U.S. are kind of disturbing, and it needs to be altered fast. And some ways that I try to just practice a little bit of what he talks in there with, like, liberatory pedagogy happened today with second graders. We were talking about flexibility, importance of moving, and then the two girls go on a rant for like 15 minutes about talking about what it means to teach and learn. And from their lens, which was just really interesting, because they were trying to relay information on how they learn to do different gymnastics moves. And at that moment, you know, you just got to step back to kind of allow students to take the floor and have the ownership of it. And even with older kids, just allowing platforms for them to challenge anything I say. We're like setting up scenarios while forcing them to challenge so that we can open up conversations. So I know there's still a ton that I have to work on, but this is definitely an eye-opening piece that needs to be engaged with in the actual school climate, not just outside of it at like podcasts and stuff. So this is refreshing. So thanks, Ash.
Yeah, I'll hop in and give my feedback to the blog and the paper. You know, stepping back, certainly it was a paper that, from my perspective, was tough to wrap your head around. With my perspectives and upbringing as a white male coming from a privileged middle class background that did not experience the oppression that was, you know, systemic in our country. So that made me pause and reflect about critical race theory in the legal sense and the totality of critical race theory, but then applying it to the educational perspective and framework. So some of the talking points or pieces that I garnered from Ash's blog and the paper itself is some of the educational parallels that align the scholarship of Black Pete research and the activism that has uniformity that Black men and women were universally oppressed. And I have not fully experienced those things. I could never begin to understand some of that oppression within the context of education or social justice matters themselves. So this paper is challenging me from the status quo that we're currently in right now in education. And I think that's one of the big pieces that the author mentions is the status quo and changing the status quo. And a quote that resonated with me specifically from the paper is, just because teachers are prepared to utilize students' cultures as assets in their pedagogy, that those students will be able to sustain their linguistic and cultural heritages while also gaining access to the dominant culture. So that's something that really resonated with me, and having the sustainability to use those cultural, linguistic, and access, not to assimilate, but to stand out in the communities and societies that they're living in. And so those were my thoughts, and you know, changing the status quo and some of the intentionality and explicit nature that we need to go about that process in education, and really taking a step back and listening to voices in the Black communities, because they have the perspective and the pulse to make those changes. And I think, coming from my educational perspective and the position that I'm in right now, taking a step back and listening and understanding and trying to apply those to my profession for sure. So those are my thoughts.
I'll jump in next if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, apologies, I missed the first couple, but I think the gist of what I'm hearing is it's difficult to discuss, to solve, in inverted commas, to sort of understand issues of racism through a white lens. I think that's what I'm feeling from the room at the moment. And with regards to PE and sort of education in general, it's difficult to recognise or even think about how your practice can have a detrimental effect on Black people if you're unaware of the issues Black people face. So it's really, and also as a Black PE teacher, as a black male, I'm not naive to think that I've not felt the same as you guys. I'm in an education system. I've definitely, when I reflect and look back, contributed, because I was ahead of year for 3 years. And I know for a fact I contributed to sort of suppression. I contributed to the system that was systemic. So I'm definitely not sitting here as a Black man saying, "See, I told you what it was saying, what it was like. Look what white people have done." Because that's you've got to have a look in yourself. I think I've been part of that as well. So that was quite, over the summer, that was quite reflective. That was quite emotional to think about that. But yeah, a couple of things just to bring it a bit closer to the UK, because I know that's obviously the US and there are similarities, but also some differences. So I think if it gets difficult to discuss this paper for some people, because critical race theory, I if I'm being honest, I didn't know anything about it. So I was learning about it through this paper and I had a little look at some bits afterwards. But I think the stigma that's attached to it via mainstream media and politicians would put a lot of people off straight away. I think they wouldn't even engage in the conversation, but as soon as you sort of mention critical race theory. And I think the recent Sewell report, which came out, was a prime example of the difficulties faced in society with discussing racism, as it contradicted previous government reports. And it has been heavily criticised by authors from the British Medical Journal, the Royal Sociology Association. And I've been spending a lot of time digging into this because I didn't want to just be like, oh, well, jumping on the bandwagon, not actually understanding why it's inaccurate. I've read along, and it's something I've been trying to employ in my school as well, and sort of send emails out to staff, say, here's the reports they cite. And one of the reports they cite was from Michael Marmo, who wrote the work on the health equity in England. And his report was cited, but it failed to mention any of the parts where he highlighted structural racism. So if you've got a report coming out on structural racism that says we don't really see it that way, then how is a PE teacher meant to work in a system or work against that system to help? So it's difficult. It's really difficult. And I always used to think, like, if there's no voice in the room for that group, then who's going to speak for them? And who's making the policy decisions? So, yeah, it's very difficult. But I think the paper gives some really practical examples of how we can sort of not solve anything, but try and make things better. The question I have is, are teachers prepared to delve into systemic racism and reflect on how their pedagogy may facilitate this? And as soon as you get to that point where teachers are happy to be open, I think pretty much like you guys are, like, you're open to understanding and not assuming, and delve into it and reflect, then I think that is a better place. It's not the answer, and it never will be the answer. I don't know what the answer is, but it's a better place to be than I don't really understand it, so therefore I'm just going to put my head in the sand and carry on with my day-to-day. So I'll let someone else jump in, but I've got a few more bits after that.
Well, that's really, really, really interesting and helpful, and to acknowledge those challenges. Now, the report that most are talking about is one that's come out recently in the UK that basically says there is no structural racism in the UK. And funny enough, some people have gone, oh great, okay, we're all doing fine. And a lot of people have gone, you are absolutely having a laugh in terms of what's happening. And it's interesting, Mo, that you've gone back and looked at to go back and look at the reports. There's a guy in the phys ed called Michael Gard, and he came out and said, the obesity crisis is not a crisis. And he went back and looked at all the reports that have been done on this. And when people write research, I'm guilty of it, you find a quote that supports what you want to say, and you put it into the, so it's a little bit of manipulation, so-and-so. And the number of times I read citations from me and I go, well, I really say that? That's not quite what I meant when I said that. There was one that came out recently, is I don't support a models-based practice, which is the complete flip of that. So it's interesting that it's what you're talking about, this kind of selective recognition, the convenience of research to say what you want to say seems to be explicit in that piece of work that you were referring to specifically. And in the UK, I mean, I read a very interesting book, and I'm returning to it again, which is by Reno Ido Lodge, which is Why I No Longer Talk to White People About Race, which is a fantastic book. In terms of opening, you know, your eyes in terms of what's happened. And I was reading it recently because we've been doing some stuff around the university around race and racism, and we were asked to read this chapter. And there's a really big piece at the beginning when she's 4 years old, she turns around to her mum and says, when will I become white? Because all the programs she'd seen, everything she'd seen, the good guys, the good girls were white. The bad guys, the bad girls, were black. And if there were any sorts of heroes, then they were the smiling sidekick, as she describes it. And that perception of whiteness is very hard to see as when you're white. But you know, the more we get into this, the more we have to. And I guess it's really important. I mean, her argument was that as a black woman, she could talk to people about these things. But then she admitted that she could do that because she was highly educated. She had a PhD. She could speak, in her words, speak their language. So, you know, we're some of this thing, this linguistic, what does it mean to talk? What does it mean to be educated and write? You know, if you don't write the Queen's English, then, you know, if your grammar is not correct and you're not doing these things, then you're deemed to not be doing very well. And yet the vocabulary of the written word, formal written word, is very different to the vocabulary in communities. But if kids write in that kind of vernacular and that vocabulary themselves, then they get criticized for not writing properly. So we're sterilizing the written word for history. And if you go back through history is a big one for sterilizing itself anyway. You know, it's written by the winners. But then the language becomes very, very polished. So lots of things we're doing. I mean, how can we encourage all kids, but, you know, particularly, you know, black kids to be themselves and be valued for being themselves? And that to me seemed to be the biggest point, not trying to make them into us, you know. You know, one of the things I always say on the teacher education course, the PTT courses, I don't want you to be a mini me, but perhaps I do. Perhaps I am. You know, there is part of me that does that I'm not aware of. And that's a real challenge in itself. And your question around how do we prepare teachers? Not well enough would be my honest, consideration in this last process. So we do an assignment on the PGC where they have to talk about, gender or multiculturalism. Well, the term multiculturalism is not a good term, so we're going to change that for next year and actually talk about race. But lots of people talk about gender, but they don't talk about race. And now, I don't know always why that is. There's always a case of, well, I'm in a white, predominantly white area, or I'm in a predominantly black ethnic minority area, and therefore race isn't an issue. So I'm going to talk about gender because I've got 50% boys and 50% girls, which is a fine rationale. But if we don't see race as, I don't want to say an issue, but we're talking about issues here. We're talking about underrepresentation. We're talking about those sorts. So let's say if we don't see race as an issue, then, you know, maybe we're not preparing teachers well enough. He says rambling, but that's kind of where I'm thinking. So I
think it goes back to knowing your young people, so who you work with and knowing who they are. And I think from a white lens it's very difficult to know some things. So I'll give you a quick example from P, if that's okay. A simple example, and it might sound really silly, but if you understand the black body, you know that we moisturize like religion. Like, we moisturize every day, every morning. It's like it's like brushing your teeth. So how does this relate to PE? So in the changing room, you're always told in CPD, safeguarding, not checking for things, but if you notice things. So for example, if a boy in my class didn't cream his legs and he was really dry and ashy, like the banter in inverted commas would be rife in the changing room, especially not just in an all-boys school, but it would be rife. And then there's that situation where they laugh it off because they're genuinely okay with laughing around with their friends, or they laugh it off because it's a fake protective, I don't feel comfortable, but it's easier to do that. Or there's the I fight fire with fire and I punch someone, I hit someone, or I call them the same thing. And that's obviously something to deal with. But I think if you didn't understand why they're making fun of him, then you it would be difficult for you to know how to deal with it. You might just brush it off. But I think I wouldn't brush it off because I know that that's quite an embarrassing, that's quite an emotional thing to do. Like, I'm horrified if I forget to cream my hands because my hands look dry. They don't look how, I don't feel comfortable in the space if my hands are dry. I wonder if you might see someone who's homeless with dry, ashy hands. but you might see a black man whose homosexuality hands. And I think so, I don't know if it's subconscious or even consciously, like I don't look like I'm being kept well if I haven't creamed myself. So I haven't kind of taken care of my body, if that makes sense. So again, if I notice this over 3 or 4 weeks, I would be flagging that as safeguarding, because that might be the first thread of something deeper. And that's what you always talk. But I don't know if that would even be a fault on the policy or any sort of training. And the reason wouldn't be is because, like we've just said, the people who are making these policies, making these trainings, are predominantly white. So there's no one in the room to say, have you thought of this? And I think that's it might sound like a really trivial, silly example, but that's one aspect of like not understanding the people that you're with on a day-to-day basis, and how race has an impact on those kind of things. So I don't know if that makes sense to people, what people think.
Well, first thing I'd say is it's not trivial, it's every day, and there's a difference between the two things. And I'll put my hand up, I didn't know that.
That is, I think that's a good example. My experience teaching high school, that was one of the first things I learned when I worked in the South Bronx in New York City, and then I moved to Philadelphia, is that moisturizer is very important because skin's different. And that is one that kids always knew. I had multiple things of moisturizer in my, like, the office, so that'd be like a norm. Before phys ed starts, kids would know. They can just go in, they can get it, walk out. And another one is hair. It's another like small thing, but I've always noticed that too, depending on when some girls had their braids done or hair like changed up. You could tell their mood changes depending on how tight braids are. And that was always an interesting one. And I actually had a student just 2 days ago. He was not having a good day. I guess his mom was prepping his hair so that he could go to the shop and then get it braided, so it was out. But she used like the little braids, I guess, ties that you use for the end, like if you were to do it, so like the real small ones, and wrapped like 3 or 4 of them around his head. So he was having an immense headache, which was resulting in a huge behavioral outburst that day. And then once we like sat down and figured it out, I was like, dude, I would be freaking out too. Like even when I tie my hair up, if it's tight. And it's just those like little things that even the teacher, his classroom teacher, hadn't a clue what was going on. And she's been teaching in Philly in the area for a long time. I was just like, his hair, like he has a headache, like it's pulling his scalp. Like, of course he's going to have an off day right now. And after that, he was fine the rest of the day. But it's just like those little things that even in the paper it references as invisibility. And like when I was in undergrad many years ago, it seems now, in my class cohort, I think there were only maybe 3 black students and maybe somebody that was Hispanic out of 130 other people. So even having those conversations in those spaces never occurred. It really wouldn't occur unless you asked like personal questions or had that relationship. And I know that was like 2008 to 2012, and it is, society is, I don't want to say immensely changed, but like in the context of what the conversations are they have. So this is like goes back to that idea of, well, if you're going into a community, you should assimilate into that community. You should literally take the time, energy, and effort to study, ask questions, and try to understand what life is like. And that's been probably the most helpful thing for me, is literally stepping back, be like, you got to educate me. I'm here. I really want to learn about you, which is like one of my first rule for my class is be yourself, and then explain how to do that and like what ways that we can communicate with each other. Had relative success over the last few years, but it's tough because there's so many interactions that you have to really understand your students before you can actually start legitimately teaching and letting them lead the way. So that's just my experience.
I agree. I'm glad that Mo shared that example, and that it's exactly right. It's not trivial at all. It's day to day. And fortunately for me, that's something I learned in my past experiences in teaching children, people of color and black communities. And so it's something I learned by experience. So I'm glad he shared that. And I think some excellent points. And you know, I referenced a book, Ash referenced the book, and I apologize for not mentioning the book, but Why Do All the Black Children Sit Together in the Cafeteria by Dr. Tatum, a great book that I took part in a book club. And when, you know, Mo mentions the white lens, and I love that analogy. And, you know, it's not lost on me that 5 of 6 of our guests today are white, and one being a person of color, right? So I certainly understand where I come from and my privilege in this discussion. And when reading that book, you know, we have to think about how we identify ourselves. And that was something I learned in from that book itself that I think resonates with today's discussion. When white people, when they're asked, who are you? How, you know, I am. They very rarely reference their race. But people in the minority, that's one of the first things they do reference, because they always are reminded of the fact that they are in the minority. And I think that's something that underlies, again, Langston's article as well. And then, you know, I think he also points to a couple elephants in the room, you know, representation, again, Black representation in physical education, Black in PEAT. That can't be lost in this discussion. And then, you know, some of the issues that I've researched and written about as well regarding Black girls in the United States and how they are the have-nots of physical education and physical activity. That's important. And Langston captures that well.
I think going back to hair and just body as well, like if we go back to PE, so swimming is an example in the paper. I think he mentions about limited opportunities. And I think in the UK anyway, it's quite limited for some kids anyway, because if you don't have a pool in your school, it's quite expensive to go and take classes with PE. But I think if you are adopting a critical race pedagogy, that and you want to provide opportunities for black young people, then I think swimming should be something you push, and you try and sort of be creative about how you can get Black people to enjoy swimming or to explore swimming, because some of them may never do that as a young child for a number of reasons, not just because they're Black, but also in terms of hair. Like my sisters, if they need to wash their hair, that's booking a day out. That's a day to do their hair. Like, so that kind of thing really makes a difference to, okay, well, we've got swimming next week. That's not going to work for me because I need to plan. I need to plan what's going to happen to my hair afterwards. I can't have 2 minutes for you screaming and shouting at me for change, because then I'm going to be in distress for the rest of the day. Then I'm going to be in distress for the rest of the week. I don't want to go to school next week because my hair looks like this and so forth. So it's just understanding, like you say, the different, not everyone is the same. Not everyone accesses the space exactly the same. And the other example is golf, which at the moment I absolutely love at the moment. And the parent said this to me recently. She said, please make sure, and she made me promise, that you offer opportunities for Black boys to engage in golf. And I said, I will, 100% I will. It was never a question. I was always going to engage any pupil. I wasn't specifically going to sort that, but she made it really clear that she wanted me to do that. And I started reflecting on that. And it's not just economic with golf. It's a very white, heavily class-based sport. And I think we would probably all understand that. And I love golf, and I've recently started having lessons again. But I realized I don't think I would have gone into golf if I wasn't a PE teacher. So I took kids as a PE teacher. So I'm not now attending a golf facility as a Black man. I'm attending it as a PE teacher. So I kind of feel like I'm okay to be here. But I still felt, and I was reflecting this last night, I felt apologetic. I felt like I had to just be, look, I'm okay. I'm kind of be invisible so as not to disturb anyone. And that's just the way I felt. That's not saying anyone made me come up to me and said anything to me, not at all. But it goes back to that Brian Culp's work, what you guys did a few months ago about the space is not the same for everyone, and it's not the same for Black people. That's just the fact of how it is. And when you, I think the critical race theory was about counter storytelling. This is not me having a rant and saying golf is racist and then they wouldn't accept me. That's just my story of how I feel. And I feel exactly the same with a pub. I feel exactly the same when I used to go football. I'm a West Ham fan. like they're the areas that I felt uncomfortable. But as a PE teacher, I'm able to, and as you're getting older, you explore them. But I think young people wouldn't feel comfortable to explore them.
I think those ideas around preparedness are really important. When we talked about trauma experience young people, one of the messages that came out of that was to not change things around, to give them an idea of what was happening well in advance so they could plan for them and there weren't surprises. And there's another example here in terms of, well, the swimming example about, you know, we can't do things on a whim. And a number of times that, you know, I used to walk into the PE, you know, my boss would go, oh, we're not doing that, we're doing this. Because, you know, he kind of had a hunch that he wanted to do something different. And you just kind of roll with the punches, you chuck your lesson plan out the window and you get on with what you're doing. But there are, you know, very, very overt, well, very, not overt because you don't see them, but there are some very real issues with that for lots of students and lots of individuals in terms of that ad hoc approach. So, you know, for lots of different students is really, really important. I mean, we were doing this questionnaire yesterday, the white privilege test, and there were some other questions that got me here. So, and we can talk about this. So I can go shopping alone and be sure that I won't be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television, open a newspaper and see people of my race widely represented. I can go to a museum or art gallery and see people of my race widely represented in the objects and artworks. I can be sure that when told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my colour made it what it was. And there were 26 questions. And I probably hit 24 out of 26. And yeah, reading through that and understanding that of having on the back of having read this paper and other books and stuff, it was just that, you know, awareness. And you know, Mo, you've been very kind to me and said that, you know, I'm aware of my white privilege. I'm not sure I am. I'm aware that white privilege exists, but I'm not sure I'm aware in the level of what my white privilege is. And I don't think it's not a, you know, racism is not one thing. White privilege is not one thing. It's both a concept and an experience. And I don't know how I'm experiencing it. I want to know how I'm experiencing it, which is why I wrote the blog and tried to understand it. But I don't think I do, because it's, you know, it's the minutiae of interactions and ignorances and everything else that they're so inherent, I'm not aware of them. I want to be aware of them, but I'm not. So I apologize for that openly and unreservedly. I will try to get better, but I have them and they exist in everything that I do. And I can't say much else really.
I would agree with you, Ash. I think we can, you know, from a white lens, can all reservedly apologize and say where we can get better and not. And the fact, you know, it's a journey and we're always learning. And I welcome these discussions to learn more and to understand, you know, some of these things that you're right, that are ingrained not only within society, within education, but within physical education, but within myself as well. So I applaud you for being modest and humble. I feel the same way. And I also applaud Mo for being vulnerable right now and sharing some of his personal convictions and some of his, you know, personal stories. That's not easy to do. You know, kudos to Mo as well.
I think, Clancy, it goes back to the paper where it says, Black people have not a responsibility, but I feel it as a duty to be the forefront of making a positive change. And that's why I suppose you guys can't fully experience it, because you're not Black. And I think that's just how it is. And that's why systems can't change themselves, because if the system is run by the majority. And I think that line, the people in power are pragmatic when working on behalf of those without it, I thought that was amazing. Like, that just summed up everything. So of course there's only only so much can happen with the way the things are. So I kind of saw this paper as a to put Black people at the forefront of making a positive change and facilitating long-term development in PE for Black people. And then also, but not conforming and not shallow notions of equality and diversity, but be leading through the community and the community becoming self-regulating. And I think that for me is a challenge. It's a challenge that I'm like willing to accept. And I have to accept and I will always accept because I have a young son now and he was around you in the summer and that was all.
We lose some of the conversation here as Mo loses his internet connection.
Or am I going to be able to have a different conversation with him when he's of an age? So, yeah, I think it's definitely about this paper to me seems like about not about, OK, what can we do? What assemblies can we do? What resources can we make? What CPD can we do? It's about Black people coming to the forefront as Black people, not Black people trying to fit into a system that is not made for Black people, does not have Black people at the heart of the conversation and uplifting their communities and self-regulating their communities and not from a place of resentment or ranting, so like that counter storytelling. And I think the more stories we tell, so yeah, even though you guys are saying emotional for me, it's actually quite therapeutic and I feel like I'm doing a part. I'm not doing everything, but I'm doing a part. I'm having a go by actually being here and sharing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and we have to be allies in that. We have to stick our necks out and we have to hold people accountable, because if we don't do that with in the privileged positions that we're in, then you know it's not going to get better in the way. So we have to, you know, so I'd like to think that I'm an ally, but I'm going to make mistakes and I'm not going to be scared and I'm going to back away from conversations, and it's just, you know, trying to make it less so, I guess.
Well, Ash, I would agree. I echo ally is a wonderful term. And Dr. Hassan James out of the United States, another PE scholar, uses the term imperfect ally. And that's what I think we are. You know, we make mistakes. We're learning, but we are imperfect allies, and that can't be lost. And I want to also just echo Mo's quote and citation, because I really center on that quote, but also a couple sentences down when Langston talks about people of Black people or people of direct African descent does not occur unless it occurs with white motives. And that's the challenge that Ash just referenced. And I would say that we have to recognize that challenge and move in the direction of not thinking about white motives anymore, but thinking about human motives. That's where we have to go.
I always have to. That bell. I despise it. The bell needs to go. But almost every single time, whenever I hear people reference with like the imperfect ally and the self-identification of that, I think it's a good direction to go. But like, people should also be aware that you can't claim yourself as an ally until you demonstrate it, because that other person's never really going to know you as an ally until it's actually demonstrated in action. And I think that's a reality that if you're decentralizing whiteness, you're almost essentially dedicating yourself as a service professional. If you go to a school or community that's very diverse and it's kind of flip-flopped for you, how are you positioning yourself to be there and acknowledge the voices and supply what people need? And that's what I try to do, but it's imperfect. But I always like to throw that little caution into the wind. Just be mindful, because if somebody just walks up to you on the street, how do they ever know you're actually an ally in life? Action.
Again, and then it's difficult because the last, you know, I've got, you know, friends who female friends who get very frustrated when people mansplain things to them. And what I would not want to do is, you know, kind of white-splain something to somebody, you know, and it's, you know, so it's that, you know, leave, you know, don't be mean to this person because he's black, you know. And you kind of think, well, am I doing that through a lens of whiteness? So you kind of have that, how do I do this by being an ally, as you say? And I completely agree with what you say, Stephen. You know, you're not an ally until you actually do something. You know, you can make a declaration, as many countries have in war, and then not gone to war, and therefore you're not really an ally, I guess. And it's the same thing, you know. But there's that counterbalance, I say, between that doing it and then doing it. And fear then stops you, doesn't it? So fear of not getting involved, fear of getting involved, leads to kind of indecision and then not getting involved. So,
but I think that's the fact that you chose this paper is a start. And I live off the mantra of some is better than none, because we just, like, it's impossible. It's an impossible task to sit here and, like, how can I do A, B, C, and D? But I like you, the fact that you chose the paper, the fact that we're talking about it now, is some is better than none, in my opinion. Can't go to war by yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Mo. And this conversation, sitting back and listening, has certainly humbled me in this journey. And your points of relevancy to students of color and their application in education and learning about that is something that I certainly need to be more aware of and put that more into practice. And your points are really well taken, and counter storytelling, providing the alternate narratives from people of color, and they need to be at the table when making these decisions, I think is critical. And the another thing that really struck me is that the uplifting of marginalized communities need to come from within marginalized communities and not from the ivory tower of white privilege and the privileged positions that people often in education have. The people that are in these communities that are people of color have the perspective to be able to make those changes and those connections. And we need to step back and listen. So, great conversation.
That's a good point, Michael, too. I think I think Steve has chatted about this in other podcasts, about the savior mentality in urban education and in other areas, and dealing with minority students as well, that we have to be careful of that approach. And I think you capture that well, Michael.
I'm just aware of time, so any short, I'm afraid, but concluding thoughts are most welcome, or equally, none.
I'll end with a quote, if that's okay. I don't know directly who it's from, but I heard John Amici say it when he was talking on TalkSport, and it was during the time of like Black Lives Matter, the height of it, and we're still in that time now. But he said that the pretense of empathy is more dangerous than open contempt, and I think that's going back to the action, the point about action. It's great to make a start, it's great to talk, and it's great to discuss, but I think if you can affect your immediate circle, so if that's your pupils, if you're head of department, if that's your curriculum, if you're a senior leader, if that's your policies, your anti-racist policy or anything like that, then you're not just having a pretense of, oh, I understand it's difficult, and then you're carrying on with your day to day, but you are actually trying to actively make a change. And I've experienced this, trying to do it in a school is difficult because people find it difficult to have a conversation, but I would just employ anyone to carry on. Just keep doing it. If the good things you do in the dark will come out in the light. That's another good friend of mine always said that to me, and that stuck with me. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to finish it around about there, but Rennie, in her book, she says she'd much prefer to speak to white supremacists about race, because at least they know where they're coming from and they have a fixed opinion. You know, having conversations in the middle ground is much more difficult. I just think we need to remember that you know, yeah, our ambiguity and our indecision is part of the problem.
And that's where our discussions ended. I'd like to thank Charlie, Mo, Michael, Stephen and Clancy for their thoughts. If you'd like to join the panel when we discuss next week's paper and can be available on Thursdays at 5 p.m. British Summer Time, then just drop me an email at Loughborough University. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and hopefully you'll choose to catch up with us next time.